Skin Podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Collins, and this is episode 135. Happy 2017, everybody. I figured I've been planning to do a podcast, and I thought, why not do it on New Year's Day? My very, very first podcast that I ever did was New Year's Day 2009. So that's 8 years ago now, and I've only done 135 episodes. But anyway, never mind. So happy new year. I hope everybody has a fantastic new year full of amazing vegan advocacy, new vegan products in your community and your local restaurants, and new vegan restaurants opening, and new vegan shoe stores, and basically more moving towards our vegan world that we're creating. I have a very big year coming up. Major changes are going to be happening in my life. They're going to affect my street stall a bit, so I am a bit trepidatious about it, but a lot happened. So I'm going to be going. I basically, earlier this year, I started looking around to see. Sorry, I just have to look at the mice cages. I feel like there's something. No, they're all right. What was I saying? I started looking around for university degrees that I might do to have a better income, basically. Auckland is an unbelievably expensive place to live. It's just shocking. And while I'm trying to learn how to be happy without focusing on material things and all of that acceptance and everything, I did just figure, have a look around, because things at my job were really bad and I thought I might be going back to the National Contact Center, which was just a sweatshop. It was so unhealthy, such a horrible, horrible, detrimental job that I did. It caused me RSI in my hands, it was depressing. It was just an awful. I just couldn't handle it. And I had been on secondment in another department, which I really enjoyed, but I wasn't really sure what was going to happen. And we had a change of manager, and he was the manager who was sort of vouching for me for my secondment. A secondment, in case you're not from New Zealand, is where you're temporarily assigned to another department to fill a gap if they have an employee leave. And it gives you a chance to explore another avenue of your work. You don't get a pay raise or anything, but you're just sort of in a different area, and then it's a certain amount of time, and then you have to go back to your substantive position. But they kept extending my secondment with the promise that they were going to find me the permanent job, and it just kept not happening, and the looming threat of returning to my substantive position at the contact center was hanging over my head. And I just thought, well, I feel energized because I'd been away from the contact center for a good almost 2 years, and I'd been resting because I wasn't working there, so anything that's not there is almost like rest, even though I was still working 40 hours a week. And I just thought, let me just have a look around. And long story short, I didn't know what to do, and I thought, well, I want to do something that where I feel fulfilled. You know, I have to have self-interest, but I do enjoy helping people, and I'd like to work in a way that helps people. I'd like to get up every day and think that I'm helping people. So, you know, and that's self-interest, I admit, but it's what I like. I like to help people. So I looked at speech-language therapy, and I met a speech-language therapist, and they said that there's very little work available because there's tons and tons of graduates, and it's just saturated with graduates, and it's really hard to find a job. But I just thought, well, I have to do something, and that's going to get me a job eventually, and I'm just going to do that. But then I noticed on the website that I was looking at, the career website, the job opportunity meter, there's a meter in the job opportunity. On the left it says poor, in the middle it says fair, and on the right it says good or something. So speech language therapy was poor in terms of job opportunities, but I noticed a link to audiology. So I clicked on that and I had a look, and an audiologist is someone who helps people who have hearing impairment. So you work with diagnosing hearing loss. You can diagnose deafness. You don't you generally don't manage with profound deafness. So if somebody is profoundly deaf, then they will move on to other services. You're mostly dealing with people who have hearing loss, but you can diagnose deafness, including in infants, if you want to specialize in pediatrics, or right up until, you know, you do hearing tests and you work with people's hearing aids and you find them the best hearing aids. There is obviously, I know that there is greed everywhere, and there's probably really greedy companies who mark up their hearing aids really high. I don't want to work in that. I would probably want to work in the public health system. But anyway, the job meter was pointed all the way to the right. It said very good, and I thought, oh, and then the remuneration was much higher than anything I've ever even begun to have, and I thought, well, why not go for it? The thing is that the master's program, only 14 people get picked to get in each year. That's not very many. And I don't really have the background. I mean, I am a sound engineer. I did do sound. The atmosphere of a audiology clinic is very familiar to me, because it's a windowless room with microphones and speakers and, you know, equipment, and I'm just very comfortable in that environment. But I don't have the biology background or the psychology background. But I've worked in the job that I've worked with, where I've worked with social workers for the last 6 years, I feel like I've learned quite a bit about psychology sort of peripherally. Maybe not necessarily related to this clinical work that I'll be doing. But anyway, long story short, I applied. It was a massive process. I didn't think I was going to get in, but I just thought, I just have to try. And then if it didn't work out, I'd probably still consider speech-language therapy. But the speech-language therapy is a 4-year degree, which is 4 years of study, as opposed to a master's, which is only 2 years of study. And given my age, I don't want to say age is that limiting, but it is a factor. And when you're going into massive debt, quitting your job and going back to square one and making yourself incredibly vulnerable financially all over again, doing it for 4 years and then having quite a low prospect of a good job on the graduation is a lot more intimidating than doing it for 2 years and having a really good chance of getting a job on graduation. So I applied. And I didn't think I was going to get in, and I was willing to accept that I wasn't going to get in. But I just thought, just try. And I can't believe it, but I actually got in. It's unbelievable. That's really life-changing, because it means I am going to quit my job and I'm going to be so broke and I'm going to be really financially vulnerable. But my mother's there with her retirement savings, which I know sounds really horrible, but of course I will pay her back. But if I need an emergency money, if one of my animals gets really sick or something like that, and I just don't have, you know, the ability to pay for it, I can go to my mother if my car breaks down and things like that. So she's my support person. Without her, I wouldn't be able to do it. But it does mean that I'm going to be studying full-time master's. It's an extremely demanding course. I have to get top, 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 top grades, or I won't get through to the second year and the whole thing will have been a waste of time. So I really, really have to. I'm almost like planning it like a Zen kind of monk-like sort of existence, where I'm just fully immersed. I mean, it's only 2 years and I'm just going to plunge myself into it. But it means I will have to eventually, the first few months, I've been saving money all year. One of the things I've been doing is not making almond milk. I love my homemade almond milk, but almonds are so expensive. And in New Zealand, it's just, you just have no idea how expensive things are here. You just won't believe it if I tell you. So I was at the street stall one day, and I was thinking, what am I going to tell people who I meet at the street stall who are poor and can't afford almond milk and can't afford, I'm just going to turn off my emails, I'm getting these messages, you know, and can't afford to buy fresh almonds and make their own almond milk. And I thought, well, peanuts are really cheap. And I bet you can make milk out of peanuts. And I googled it, because I thought, that's what I'm going to do, because I've been sort of planning all year. I've been acting all year as if I'm going to get into uni, even though I really didn't believe it. So I've been trying to save as much money as I possibly can and cutting down on things that I consider to be luxuries. And so I started making peanut milk. I googled it, and sure enough, I found you just buy the blanched peanuts, which are about less than a quarter of a price of almonds, or maybe a quarter of the price of almonds, or even cheaper if you buy from some of the other places. And you soak them and you blend them and you squeeze the milk out just like you do any other raw nut, you know, plant milk. But it's a pretty strong, because I was thinking this is what I'm going to tell people who want to make their own plant milk, who can't afford to buy the soy milk and the almond milk in the supermarket and who have a food processor. I was like, oh, this is what I'm going to tell low-income people. And I have suggested it to some people, but oh, it's a really strong flavor. Raw peanuts have an unbelievably, it's hard to describe the flavor. But anyway, I'm kind of getting used to it, but it's certainly, it does the job. And it you know, it dilutes your coffee, or well, I don't drink coffee, but your tea or whatever. You can put it in your buckwheat cereal. You can use it just like, it's a lovely, creamy, versatile milk. It doesn't go off nearly as quickly, but it's really strange, weird peanut flavor. But I go for it because it's not like it, you know, it doesn't taste like, you know, I'm not going to say it tastes good, but it certainly is not, I mean, it doesn't taste rancid or anything. It's just, it's unusual and you just kind of have to get used to it. But it certainly does the job. It's a milk that you can use, and I use it in cooking and anything that I would normally use plant milk in, I use peanut milk. You might have to add a bit more flavoring to your sauces and stuff just to sort of override that peanut flavor. But anyway, I've been doing that all year and I love my yoga, but I stopped paying for the yoga. And you know, but the barter system is still existent these days. Don't underestimate that, because I told them, I said, I'm thinking of applying for university and I have no idea if I'm going to get in. I'm not going to find out until the end of the year, but I'm going to act like I'm getting in so that I am prepared and I have to save money and I'm not going to come to yoga anymore. I can't afford it. And they said, well, you know, we have people who clean the studio and they get free classes. So I've been cleaning the yoga studio Monday nights, and I can come as much as I want. So I go to the evening class, I go to the late class on Monday, stay for the class, do the class, and then afterwards everybody goes home and I clean the studio, and I can go as much as I was going before completely for free, which I think is amazing, and I love them for that. It does make for a very rough Tuesday morning, believe me, because I don't get home till about midnight. And it's about 2 hours of quite full-on cleaning. But, I mean, for free yoga classes, it's worth it. So I'm going to do that until the end of the year. And then once I'm in uni, I'm going to only be doing yoga in my house. I have a DVD and stuff, but it just doesn't really compare to the studio experience. And I've been doing hot yoga, which I love because I hate the cold. And in the winter, it was so nice to go to the yoga studio and be so warm and sweat. I'm going to miss that. But anyway, these are the little sacrifices that you make. That's only going to be for 2 years. Another thing that's going to be impacted is my street stall, because I'm not going to be paying for all the printing and all the cupcake ingredients, and I'm going to be probably working the first semester. I'm going to be full on trying to get the top grades I can get, just immersed in study, just completely and utterly head down, tail up. And then after that, I'm going to have to get a job eventually, because I do have some savings, but I mean, I did my best, but it's going to run out and I'm going to have to work. They don't advise that you work, but they know that some of us have to. I mean, we just, you know. So I'll be working weekends, no doubt. So I'll be basically 7 days a week. So Jeff, lucky for me, Jeff Lyons, who's been doing the stall with me for a good while now, has told me he's going to take over the stall. So I'm going to give him the table, and he might even make it a lot better, because he's a bit sick of the sort of grungy and dirty nature of my stall and sort of the rubber band and sellotape kind of setup that it is. And he might even get a nice new display and stuff going, and that's great. Go for it. And I, you know, I'd love to be able to sort of drop by, like, you know, I won't be doing all the, because it does take quite a bit of work. I mean, it's one of my favorite things to do, but you don't just sort of show up. I mean, when you're the one who's sort of in charge of it, you have to, you know, you spend the night before making all the cupcakes, and then you pack everything. You make sure you've got enough printing. That means going down, getting all the printing done, which is time consuming, because it takes a while to photocopy and print. You know, you're sort of standing there waiting, and you have to wait in line. A lot of times these print places are quite busy. And so you do all that, and you have to make sure that you remember to do all that, and then you go drive there, you know, and you set everything up, and then you sort of in charge of everything, you know, of all the equipment, and then you take it all down, and it's like a full day, and then there's a few other hours that you're doing on the printing and the baking or whatever. But if Jeff takes it over, and then maybe one Saturday, if I have got a couple of hours free, I can just pop down and just be like, hey, and I can just hang out, and then I can just, if I have to go do an assignment or something, I can just go home and I don't have to worry. And Jeff said he's very willing to do that, but he'd really love somebody to help him and be there, and rather than me, who might not even be able to come. And he doesn't want to do it by himself, and I don't blame him. I know. I did it by myself and everything. It's just so much more fun with somebody else, because when there's, you know, when you're sitting there and, you know, it's a quiet moment, you can talk, and you just talk, and I find that people sort of, you get, I can't really remember too much, because I've been getting helped by Jeff so much that I can't really remember what it was like to do it by myself, but I feel like we're getting more people, although that could just be because of the rise in veganism. But anyway, so if anybody's listening who lives in Auckland, who is an abolitionist, I mean, I don't know, but if you really would just love to help with the street stall, and you can coordinate with Jeff and help him out, you can share all of the burden, and you know, that would be so great. I would really, really love to see the stall keep going even while I'm at uni. I really, really would love to see that happen. So that's what I'm really hoping. But I'm going to be at uni, and it's a whole new opportunity for me to advocate. I failed miserably at creating like a group at AUT. I'm not going to try to organize any kind of group. I'm not going to have time for that. But I'm going to be vegans advocate all the day, every day, wherever you are. And so I'm going to see what happens. And I'm going to be meeting lots of young people, people who are interested in education, hopefully a lot of critical thinking, although I don't think it's going to be any different than everybody else. I mean, it just depends on how seriously you take, you know, other animal interests and how open you are to reflecting on that. And I don't see what's, you know, I think being on the street is, you meet people just as likely to meet people, maybe even more likely to meet people there. Even Anna Charlton said yesterday at this fantastic webinar that Gary Francione and Anna Charlton did, which was so great. It was a 2-hour webinar on advocacy. And it was just really wonderful. I love these webinars. Ben McKellen has been setting them up, and the quality was great, and it was just such a cool vibe. And one of the things Anna said, because, you know, as Anna, I keep saying Anna, but her name is Anna. I don't know why I keep saying Anna. Anna said that she at the university, it's not, sometimes there's even people, like the more intellectual people, seeming people, can be even more shut down to just openly confronting, you know, their animal use and stuff, because sometimes their brain gets in the way. That's what I found as well. In terms of, like, they're just, they're overthinking or overanalysis, or maybe ego. I mean, maybe there's a lot of ego of amongst people who are, you know, because there's a lot of ego involved with the education, you know, the academic world. So that was an interesting thing. But anyway, there's so much to talk about. So that's, anyway, I've spent a lot of time talking about myself. So that's my new year, and it's going to start in March, and I haven't officially given my notice at my job yet. But I have to tell you, one of the things that really brought it home to me about how I really want to change my personal situation and where I really, looking forward to the future, I was like, I need to get a better job in this city, because I'm living in, I have a place where I don't have another room, so I have a sort of a long, narrow kitchen area, and I have like a toilet and a shower kind of tacked onto the end of the apartment. But then there's one room, like I don't have two rooms. And what happened is, at my dad's rest home, there was a cat living there, and I'd seen her, and I always asked about her. But I mean, my dad was there for about 5 years, so that's a long time in the life of a cat. And I was always and they always said, oh yes, she's our cat, that she's the rest home cat. And I thought, okay, that's good. But then I just started to see her, and she was getting old, and I was like, this isn't good, because she's getting old, and who's really taking care of her? I mean, when they say this is the rest home cat, does that mean that, oh, and what they said is that she just showed up one day. She was clearly abandoned. She just started hanging around, so they started giving her food. So I was getting worried about her, because she was getting old, and when cats get old, they need a lot more medical intervention, because they get all kinds of problems from the domestication and the terrible diets that they're on, and just the breeding, and they get liver, they get kidney disease is so common, they get you know, and I was like, well, is she sleeping inside? What's going on with this cat? So I went there and I sat down, and she tried to jump on my lap. This is what went this. So I finally made a determined inquiry, and I said, what was the story with this cat? She's getting old, and it's very, very cold. This was winter this year that just happened, not long after I'd sort of decided to, I think I'd already started looking seriously at uni, and I made the application in June. I sent in my application in May, I think. So this definitely happened after that. Yeah. So I'd already decided to do that, but this just cemented it. And I said, who's looking after this cat? And they said, oh, you know, there's this lady whose father lives here, and the cat sleeps in his room, and they look after the cat. So I talked to her and I said, oh, hi. And I was like, hey. So I was wondering about this cat. Like, who's really, I mean, is anybody taking her to the vet? She looks like she's getting old and she's cold. And she said, oh no, I take care of her. She said, you're right, the rest home was terrible. They didn't even used to feed her properly and stuff. So I've been taking care of her these last few years, and she makes sure she has food, and she goes to visit her father several times a week for long periods, because she doesn't have work. She lives in, her husband works and she doesn't work, and so she really was looking after the cat. And she was telling me about her cats, and she had a cat. This was not long after I lost Buddha, because I lost Buddha in April, and this woman said, I had a cat who lived to 23. She had kidney disease for 9 years. And I said, how on earth did you keep her alive for 9 years? And she was telling me, but she's got these two other cats, three other cats left, so she had four, and then she just lost one, very old, and, you know, this amazing cat lover. So I was like, this cat is in good hands. And then I went back to visit not long after, and this little cat at the rest home, I sat down on the bench because I always like to give her a cuddle, and she had a really hard time jumping on my lap, very hard time. And I just said, oh, she's got arthritis or something. And I found the woman again, and I said, look, I really want to take her to the vet. And I said, I'm just worried about her, and I didn't want to insinuate that this woman wasn't doing a good job, but she wasn't there all the time. She didn't live there. And she told me that the rest home wouldn't let the cat inside. It was only in her father's room, but her father was in a rest home. He had dementia, and maybe he would forget to. And I was thinking, it's so cold, and this cat's clearly got arthritis. And I said, we really need to do something. She said, yes, you're right. And then she was galvanized, and I think she just needed that. And she said, right. So she took the cat to the vet, and then she was contacted me, and she was hysterical because the vet advised that this cat was blind. She had gone blind. And that's why she had so much trouble, because her blood pressure was so high and had been untreated, right? She hadn't had any blood pressure medication because nobody had taken her to the vet to get it done. And she had gone blind because of the blood pressure behind her eyeballs. And I can't remember the exact way, but it bursts all the blood vessels and you can go blind from high blood pressure. But when your blood pressure is that high that you've gone blind, you are in big trouble. So I said, right, that's it. This cat, you know, needs a home. And I said, we'll just take her. I said, I'll take her. And I was panicking all this while thinking, what am I going to do? I've got this one room and Jebby. And I thought, I'll just have to make it work. And she was saying, and the really scary thing was the vet, being a total speciesist, was saying that unless somebody's going to take this cat and keep her inside for the rest of her life and give her blood pressure medication, you know, three times a day, I think the best thing to do is to, as they say, put her to sleep. You know, that's the most humane thing to do. And I started to panic, and I was saying, this cannot happen. She doesn't need to be put to death. She's got a life to live, and we can take care of this. And I said, I'm going to take her. And this woman was very happy and said, thank you so much. That's great, because I just can't take her because there was just issues at her house. And I think her husband just was putting his foot down about it, saying, I don't want another cat. They had three already. They just lost one. But I was kind of mad because I was like, you've got this big house. I mean, I hadn't seen it, but I imagined that they had this big old house with all these rooms. And I was like, oh. But anyway, I was like, I have to do something. So I was really racking my brains about how I was going to make it work with this cat. and Jebi and keeping this cat inside, and but then I would have to lock Jebi out of the room, but then that's Jebi wouldn't have anywhere to go, like her food, and it was the middle of winter, so it's freezing, and my house is freezing cold, and I just keep only the one room heated, so I have to shut it all. Anyway, I was like, whatever is going to happen is better than this cat being put to death, which is what all these people want to do. So I was saying, I'm going to take her, and at that time, the lady didn't know about my living situation, and she said, that's great. And then I was thinking, what am I going to do to keep this cat contained and safe from Jebi, and keep this cat safe? This cat is blind, she's completely helpless. And this woman had mentioned she had one of those big floor cages, you know, there's like an enclosed, like a big cage, like a dog cage. And I said, oh, can I borrow this cage? I really want to borrow this cage because, you know, I promise I'll give it back. And she was like, oh, because we didn't even hardly know each other, really. We only just met over this cat. She said, oh, I don't know. And I said, you know, you have to give it back. I use it. And I said, no, I know. I promise I'll give it. I just really need it because I just have this one room and I'm really concerned about what, you know, how I'm going to make this work. And when she found that out, she said, well, you can't take her. That's too bad. How are you going to manage? She's blind and you have another cat and you don't have a room that you can keep her safe in. And she started to talk about, no, I don't. I think it was just panic in the moment and it's just the general speciesism. But she was saying, well, I think the best thing to do is to have her put to sleep because this is, you know, and I just freaked out and was like, you cannot, and I'm panicking meanwhile because I'm all the way across town stuck at work and they're on the other side of the city because it's quite far from where I live, gonna pick her up that day, gonna pick the cat up that day and keep her there so that I can go and get her. And I'm thinking, oh my God, she's gonna kill her and it's gonna be my fault. Because I, you know, and I just was like, please, you can't do this, you can't, I, you know, that's wrong. She said, but it's no quality of life, you know, the usual sort of, well, you know, this is what animal welfare does. It's like, instead of doing everything you can to make the life, it's like, well, the easiest thing to do is to just have them put to death. But I think she was just, I don't think she actually would have done it, but she, when she texted me that, I freaked out and rang, and anyway, argued, and I said, you know, you can't. And then she said, okay, fine. And I said, right. I was freaking out. And I was like, please don't do anything. You know, I'm coming there tonight after work. I'm coming. Just keep her safe and just, I'm coming. And then, like an angel out of the sky, came Sophie and her amazing network. Because I started to panic and think, I have to find a foster carer immediately because this woman does not want to release this cat to me. She's insisting that she cannot keep this cat in her house, and she's talking about how this cat, the best thing for this cat. And the vets are all on board with that. They would have given her the injection in a heartbeat, don't doubt it. So I was on panic mode, and I was emailing, I was posting it on my wall, and I don't have a network. You know, that's one of the things about sort of isolating myself a bit. I don't have a network that I can reach out to, you know, of rescuers. This has happened to me before with a couple of other cats that crossed my path that I tried to rescue. I was completely alone in it. And that's one of the prices you pay. And it's a bad price. But luckily for me, I have Sophie, who makes my cupcakes for the street stall and does all kinds of other fantastic charity work. She's an amazing person. Never met anyone like her. And I wrote to her and said, can you please put this out to your network? This is a very desperate situation and, you know, please can you just maybe just find someone. And I actually didn't have a lot of hope. I was thinking, no, I just have to battle. I'm going to go over there and I'm going to battle for this cat and we're just going to, things are going to be okay. And then, miracle of miracles, this an amazing rescuer called Golnaz, who has rescued tons of animals and is an active rescuer, wrote to Sophie and said, I'll take her. This is a foster carer, like, I'll foster her, just like that. And you cannot imagine the joy that I just was like, thank you so much. And so I wrote to, you know, so I got in touch with the woman and I said, we've got a foster carer who's, you know, and we took her over there and Golnaz welcomed her. And she herself had a blind cat and a deaf cat, very old, and she was just really looked after her amazingly well. And then we said, we're going to try to find her a home. But, you know, the foster carer said, just take your time. She can stay here as long as she needs. And it was a beautiful thing. And in the end, So I was saying, okay, when do you want me to put an ad out? Not that I really, you know, have a big network, but I was thinking we can put it on Pets on the Net. We can do all kinds of things to actively try to find a permanent home. And they were saying, well, just wait because she needs to stabilize on her medication. Maybe some of her sight will come back, which I think a tiny, tiny bit did, but she's really pretty much essentially blind. And everybody was telling me just to hold back. And meanwhile, the woman who helped me to rescue her, despite her brief moment of going along with these vet suggestions, she really, really fell in love with this cat. She'd been looking after her at the rest home for years and making sure she had food and worming her and giving her flea medicine. And she paid for most of the vet bills. Like I said, I'll pay. And she just kept paying. I mean, we split one big vet bill down the middle, but most of the time she paid. And then I had told the foster care, I said, listen, because I didn't know that this other woman was going to stay involved the way she did. And I said, listen, I'll just pay for all the vet bills. That'll be my way of supporting you on this because, you know, I couldn't take her and you've taken her. And I said, so you just take your cat to whichever vet, you know, take her to whatever vet whenever she needs meds or whatever, and I'll just get them to send the bill to me. And I never got a call. And then I was writing to her and saying, have you been taken to the vet? And she said, oh no, you know, this woman's just been doing that and she's been going over there almost every day because she was in love with this cat and she really wanted to adopt this cat. And the good news is that she calmed down with her whole, you know, this is, you know, and she really saw that she really wanted to give this cat a life. And I know this sounds, after what happened, you might be thinking, how could you be happy that she adopted her? But she kept her other cat alive for until they were 23, and she's very responsible. I think it was just that panic when she thought that I was going to, she didn't know me, and I think she thought I was just going to keep this cat shut up in a cage. And she just didn't know me, and she didn't know what I was going to do for this cat. And in her panic, she resorted to the speciesist, you know. But I'm not at all concerned, and we've been keeping in touch. So long story short, she finally convinced her husband that I'm sure she just said, look, I'm just adopting this cat and you're just going to have to deal with it. So she took her in. She gives her medication, which nobody else could really do except her, because the cat trusted her. And so the best outcome is that she adopted her, which I wish could have happened straight away rather than putting the cat through all that stress. But anyway... But long story short, I was looking at my situation like, this is intolerable to me. I can't rescue any animals. I can't have dogs, you know, I cannot have a dog here. I'm not allowed a dog here. I can't rescue any dogs. Anytime I come across a stray cat and it, you know, this sort of situation falls in my lap, I'm stuck in this situation because when you are trying to acclimatize a new cat, everybody, you need a separate room, and then they live in that room, and you just, it's a very big deal because they can kill each other. It can be so stressful. Maybe they can't kill each other, but they can really hurt each other, and it's just not ideal that I only have this one room for any kind of, when I try to, so I just thought, I can't, you know, I really want to be able to rescue more animals, and I'm not going to be able to do it here properly. So that was another motivation for me to get a decent job where I could actually maybe afford a halfway decent place to live where I could, you know, have a spare room and, you know, even foster. I mean, I would love to foster animals. And, you know, you just need a spare room because that's where you keep the foster animals. You keep them safe. You keep your animals safe. And so that's another reason why I'm, like, going for this, because it's a very big sacrifice, and it's going to be such a struggle. But if I can come out the other end with this degree, this audiology degree, and get a really great job, I reckon by the time I'm 50, I'll be out of debt. Hopefully I've paid back all my loans to the university, or at least mostly. So for the next 5 years, I'll still live where I'm living now, you know, or the next 5 to 7 years, I'll still live where I'm living now. And I'll hopefully I can still live here because I've lived here for so long. He hasn't raised the rent that much. And if I was not to be able to live here, I've been looking, and I don't even know where I would go in this city. I just don't even know. So fingers crossed I can stay here for another really long time. And then, you know, I'll have really good income, especially compared to anything I've ever had. At least livable in Auckland, where I have options, you know, instead of now where I have none. And I can move, and I can live in a place where I can rescue animals, and I can have people come to stay and say, "Here, there's a room for you," instead of, "Oh, well, you have to sleep on my floor, and I'm really sorry about the mouse cages, which are going to keep us up all night. Like, I get no sleep because I've got three mice cages in my room because there's nowhere else I can, keep them." And so anyway, so that's what's happening with me. So that's really big. It's pretty major. So what I'm going to do is one of the focuses I'm going to try to do is focus on the budget eating that I'm going to be doing, because I'm going to be on this super, super, super tight budget. And it's going to be good. It's going to be a challenge, because since I've been vegan, I came to New Zealand, I was just temping, and I was just and I eventually got the job that I'm working at now after I went to uni. But I wasn't really documenting on, so I'm wanting to be like, here's a student, and I'm gonna sort of figure out my budget, like how many dollars a day I have to live for, for food. And I'm gonna sort of try to do that as like an inspiration to other people who say, "Oh, well, I'm scared I'm not gonna be able to eat properly, and I'm gonna be malnourished because I don't have money," and blah blah blah. Because we all know that it's much cheaper to eat vegan, but I'm gonna sort of prove it. Whereas I haven't really had to, because I wasn't earning that much money, but I was earning enough that I could go out and buy maple syrup and make maple syrup desserts and stuff. Which, when you're really struggling, you can't afford to buy stuff like that, because it's not necessary, so it's not on your list. Like, it's not it's a luxury item. Maple syrup and dates, and almonds, and all of those things which we consider to be staples of a vegan diet, like tahini and all that stuff. Well, it's not a staple of a budget vegan diet, because tahini and almonds and maple syrup or agave, they're really overpriced in New Zealand, so they're luxury items. They're certainly not necessary. So I'm also gonna probably try to learn how to make soy milk. I was a bit intimidated, but I was like, "Oh, it looks like such a hassle." But I found another recipe which I like the look of, where instead of cooking the beans and then, boiling the beans and then straining off the beans and da da da, you actually just soak them overnight, and you do it just exactly like any other nut milk. So you soak it, put them in the blender, squeeze through the bag, and then you cook the milk. So you only have to cook the milk rather than So that you do that last. And I'm gonna try that method and see if it works out cheaper than peanut milk, because it will taste better. Although I have to take into consideration the price of the gas and the electricity. Whenever you cook anything, like I look at these recipes sometimes, and it's like, turn on your oven to 350 and roast, one little piece of some essential ingredient for this dish. Roast it for an hour. And I'm like, do you have any idea how much that's going to cost me to turn my oven on for that much, just to roast that one little thing? I mean, I can't afford to, do that. So there's all kinds of things taken into consideration. So I don't know if it'll be cheaper with the cooking time to make the soy milk, or if it's just cheaper just to do the peanut milk. But anyway, so yeah, so very exciting stuff. This podcast has been completely about my personal life, but never mind. I'm sorry about that. But let me think. Oh, another thing that I did. Okay, so I had a visit. I had a visitor who stay with me. Her name is Truk, and she came over from Sydney, and had a holiday here. And I said, as long as you don't mind sleeping sort of on my floor. I mean, obviously I put some padding down and this sort of spare sort of thing, mattressy thing that I had and stuff, but I was like, it's not, I'm really, really sorry. I wish I had a room for you. But anyway, and the mice are really noisy, and she's so easygoing, and she said, "Look, it's totally fine. I'm gonna be on holiday, so whatever." So she came and stayed. And one of the things that she wanted to do was a street stall. She's always wanted to do a street stall. And so we did it, and it was great. It was me, Jeff, and Truk, and it was on New Year's, sorry, it was on Boxing Day. And we had a great day, and I didn't actually think we were gonna have a great day, because I was completely confused, and I forgot that Boxing Day is one of the biggest retail days of the year. And I was thinking everything was gonna be closed because it's a public holiday. But the city was packed, and we had great, it was a good day. We gave away all the cupcakes really early, because I only made one dozen, because I was thinking there was going to be nobody around. because Auckland's pretty dead, lots of people go on holiday, but and we met mostly young people, we met some baby steppers, and we had to really struggle with that and talk to them, and you know, we met other vegans and we tried to talk to them about abolition, and I can't remember, you know, all the conversations, but we had a great time. And and one of the things that I learned from Truk, which she's helping me with, another clean slate thing that I'm doing for 2017. This has always been a real struggle for me. A few years ago on my podcast, I said I'm no longer gonna go to. Oopsie daisy, what was that? Oh, never mind. Well, there's a bit of a wind blowing. I stopped going to food events with my family, and I'm still going to do that. I'm not going to any of these events, but at my job. Okay, so what happened is Truk showed me a photo of, she works at a public hospital, and her team is about 7 or 8 people. So like she got a team of people who she works with, and then there's a larger team that they're all part of, right? So her team of 7 or 8 people, they had a shared, you know how you always, like, a lot of the things that we do is like we have a shared, oh, let's have a shared team lunch or a shared team morning tea or whatever. And we do that at my job all the time. And I just don't participate in food starts. I'll bring vegan food, but I've even stopped doing that, to be honest, lately, because I've actually been really feeling really busy and overwhelmed with everything that's happening. And my father's been in hospital and all this stuff. And I stopped going, and I would always leave, and they knew that I would leave, and I wouldn't sit in the room while they were having whatever it was. Like, if we welcomed a new staff member and they came to the thing, we'd always have a morning tea, and I would always go for the greeting and the welcome, because I didn't want to come across as unwelcoming. But the second the food happened, I would be gone. I just wouldn't stay. And there would be fruit and stuff on the table, and they'd be coming to me and say, do you want some fruit? Would you like some fruit? And they'd want to bring me fruit, and I'd just be like, no, thank you, no. And I just think, can this whole thing just go away and not happen? I just don't want to deal with this at all. And I found it really upsetting. And what Truk showed me is that her team made a vegan, everybody brought a vegan dish for a morning tea that they had. And that just shows me that she's a really amazing advocate to them, because that hasn't happened for me. Although in my small little team, it's happened where we've gone to a vegan restaurant. They said, we really want you to come, so please just pick a vegan restaurant so we can all, so you will definitely come. And so we did, and it was great. But our big team is about 28 people. And she did say, Truk did say that in her big, big team, it's not like everybody's brought a vegan, you know, dish. But just the fact that her team had done this for her, unprompted as well. They said, we're having a morning tea, and then everybody brought a vegan dish. And I was talking to her about it, and she was really helping me, because I said, you know, I really am full of doubt about the way I've been managing this. And it was interesting, because yesterday at the webinar with Gary Francione and Anna Charlton, they were talking about, you know, going to like family food events or whatever the case may be, and being the vegan in the room. And she did say something about how, you know, you can boycott and you can not participate. And she understands that, Anna said, and I understand it too, and I don't give people a hard time about it. I mean, I've been doing it, and I understand why people do it. But she did say, you know, you don't want to sort of be reinforcing kind of this sort of misconception that we're kind of odd or something, because, you know, what they're saying is like, it's just so normalized, And, you know, they say that the fact that you're there and you can bring the vegan food, if you can cope with being there, you don't have to look at the other products. You can just be there with your vegan food, look at your own food, and then you can be this example. And also it makes them feel like, when I'm not there, like one of the things like Truk said to me as well was like, I said, I just find it so upsetting, and I just can't stand sitting there while they're, you know, they bless the food. And the food isn't blessed to me. It is not blessed food to me. It's torture, slaughter, and death, and injustice. But she said, just look at your own food. You don't have to look at the other food. Just look at your own food, because that's what she does. And also, one of the things, sort of what Anna said and other people have said, is like, when you're in the room, they are uncomfortable and they're thinking about what they're eating, because they know why you're vegan. If you're clear and they know you, and believe me, these people know me. If they know why you're vegan and they know what you think and what it's all about, because you've had plenty of opportunity to impart that knowledge to them, if they haven't, if they've still not gone vegan, that's their speciesism, and you know it can change. Never give up hope. But they're uncomfortable, and sometimes they will feel uncomfortable about it just by you being there. And when I leave and I give them free rein and I'm just gone, they don't even have to think about it. Now, I thought that my absence might make them think about it, but I don't think it does. I think they're relieved in a way that I'm not there. Maybe, I don't know. But all I'm saying is that I wasn't really sure about the whole way that I was managing things at work. You know, I always doubt myself. I always doubt if I've done a good advocacy, if I've done the right thing, if I'm doing it wrong, you know. And I've always, never really, it's just such a challenge, isn't it? I know a lot of people can relate. So, I didn't want a morning, because I'm going to be leaving, and I've worked at this place for over 2.5 years, but I've worked in the building with this organization for 6 years now, 6 solid years. That's the longest I've ever held any job. And so I must be getting mature, but it's going to be a big goodbye, because I really do love the people I work with. I work with social workers who are incredible people. I adore them. I could never do what they do. They're amazing. What they put up with is just terrible. The low pay, the terrible conditions, the just ridiculous lack of resources. I mean, it's just shocking. And that they just come to work every day and they're just amazing and they're just helping these children and doing the best they can in a terrible system that's working against them almost every step of the way. And I'm going to miss them, and they are going to want to have a farewell, because it's what they do. They have a big farewell. And I was going to say, I don't want a farewell, because I just have not wanted to deal with this whole sitting around the table thing. I just stopped. But it still didn't get easy, because they would always come by, oh, do you want some fruit? Or, Elizabeth, come have something. Just come and have this. And I was never as easy as I thought just to walk away, because it was always this big sort of strange event. So after talking with Truk and after hearing Anna yesterday and just thinking about how I'm going to reevaluate this and how I want to be able to, because it's not about me. And if I'm losing an opportunity to do something good for other animals just because I'm feeling bad, which is what I'm saying about myself. I'm not making any judgments on any other vegans who do or don't, you know, take part. I just feel like I'm gonna try a different, and if it doesn't work and if things go really wrong and I just feel like I'm just not doing the right thing, then I won't go. But I've decided I'm gonna let them have a farewell for me. I'm going to stay. I'm not going to sneak out the door without one. And I'm going to obviously bring some vegan food for myself. I know there are people there who will bring vegan stuff for me, even if it's just fruit, like a big bowl of fruit and stuff. And I'm going to do that. And then with uni, it's like a whole fresh start, a whole bunch of new people who don't know me, who are going to learn all about veganism, because I'm going to tell them, or, you know, I'm going to make it happen in however way, you know, as long as they'll allow me to, you know, impart the information, it's going to be imparted. And I was thinking about that, and, you know, because they're, you know, university, we're all going to be really, really intensely studying, but they're probably going to want to have like a shared lunch or shared morning tea or whatever. And I'm going to go with my vegan food. I'm not going to look at the other things on the table, but I'm going to be there and I'm going to see how I go. So that's my New Year's resolution, to turn that around, try a different way, see, because I don't feel like what I've been doing for the last 4 years has been working in terms of has been doing a positive thing for advocacy. Personally, in my experience, I don't think it has. It hasn't really done much for me. It's nice not to have to sit there and, you know, smell it and stuff, but usually these things aren't cooked. I mean, if there was a certain type of, there's a limit to what I can sort of take viscerally. So like Christmas at my job, I stayed away from the kitchen. I didn't even go into the kitchen anywhere. Like the only time I ever go into the kitchen at my job is to get hot water for my tea. I just walk to the tap, fill up my hot water and leave, or I fill up my drinking water and that's it. But there's this little kitchenette on the ground floor, which means I have to go down two flights of stairs. And I was just going there just to get my hot water because I was not going into their kitchen. And I'm sure I don't have to explain why. But anyway, so it was really good to, it's always good to meet new people. That's one of the things is, you know, I am kind of looking forward to meeting new people and trying to see how I go, you know, socially, how I'm gonna be, what, you know, see how I manage, in terms of these new people. And, you know, I'm gonna be bringing this budget food. I mean, I'm gonna be making a lot of beans and rice, and a lot of lentils and roti or chapatis, however you want to call them, flatbread. I have this, there's a shop close to me that sells very good priced wheat flour, which is the atta, they call it. It just basically means flour in Hindi. But it's a specially ground combined flour that makes the most beautiful chapatis. It's the best flour you could ever use for chapatis. Other flours just don't work. And it's reasonable, so I'm going to bulk up on that. So it'll be a lot of, and thank goodness I'm not gluten intolerant ever since I had, you know, my surgery and everything. So that's going to be a big part of my diet. Plus, from a long time ago, I bought a big bulk thing of masa harina, which is the corn that you can make tortillas out of. And I still have that left, and it's preserved nicely. It's sitting in airtight containers, so I'm hoping it's going to last, because that's another sort of cheap supplement. Basically, the point is that you get the nutrition stuff, like lentils and the vegetables and stuff, but you fill up your belly with the, you get a nice full feeling with the bread, the sort of bread stuff on the side, because it's just cheaper, basically, and it's still nutritious. So I think that was everything I was going to talk about today. Basically about my sort of trying a new thing with, in regards to events and social things at my jobs and at uni and stuff. I'm going to sort of turn over a new leaf and see how I go. Always can go back if it doesn't work, if I just can't take it. I can always just go back. It's no big deal. At least I'm going to try. I want to try it because I feel like I'm going to do more. I'm going to do more good that way, I think. I hope to think. It looks like other people do. So I feel like I want to join them. And basically that's it. So I'm going to keep doing my podcast, you know, things will come up and I'll talk about them and stuff. But for the next couple of years, it's going to be me trying really, 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 really hard to get this qualification so that I can have a decent job, so that I can have a decent place to live, and maybe have a chance to rescue more animals and have wonderful vegan friends come to stay who don't have to sleep on the floor listening to the mice keeping us awake all night. But those are material things, and it is important to accept and to love and be appreciative of what you've got. So if I hadn't gone into university and I had to stay at this job where I'm at, which is going through a lot of turmoil, I'd already, in fact, I didn't think I was going to get into uni, and I got the call, I got the email that said you didn't get in. So basically the first 14 got picked and I was on a waiting list, and I thought, well, that's it, I'm not getting in. There's just no way. And I just thought, that's fine. And I went through this whole big acceptance and I was grateful. I was like, thank goodness, because it's just going to be so hard. I'm like, I'm going to keep having my income. I'll stop cleaning the yoga studio. I can just go back to paying for yoga, because whatever. I'll still save money, but whatever. I don't have to scrimp and save, you know. And I was all accepted and I was completely resolved and happy with the fact that I wasn't going to go to uni. And then a few days later, I get a call. They had a person who pulled out of the first 14 and I was first on the waiting list. Do you want to come? And I just thought, oh no, I have to go now. And so I said yes. And that's what happened. So that's a big announcement that I've been wanting to make. It's going to be great. But I'll never stop advocating veganism, and of course, once I graduate, have a job and establish, I'll totally go back to doing the street stall. And it doesn't mean I'm not going to do it at all, it just means that Jeff's going to be in charge, and I'm going to be sort of taking the easy road a bit there for a while. But I really wish I could see more abolitionist advocacy in Auckland, so it's not just, you know, one or two people. There's just seems like people want to do other stuff. They want to do the Earthlings experience, or they want to hold signs and I don't know. I really don't understand it. I don't know why. We don't want to talk with people. And you convince people of stuff, and you open their mind, and, you know, you talk with them. and you learn so much about yourself as well. It's just, to me, doing the street stall or any community advocacy where you have one-on-one engagement with people, it's just life. It's world changing. That for me is world changing. It really is. So I'm convinced of that. But anyway, so that's what I'm always going to be doing, abolitionist advocacy. I mean, I'm not a painter. If I was, I'd be painting abolitionist paintings. Or if I was a songwriter like Ben Frost, you know, I'd be writing. But luckily we have a Ben Frost who sings abolitionist songs. And we have a painter, Mariana Gonzalez, who paints beautiful abolitionist artworks. And so, you know, we're lucky. That's why we need everybody to be abolitionists, because we all have a variety of talents which we can bring to the table. So consider making 2017 your year where you get something going in your community. And that means you get up and do it, because you cannot sit around, as I've said before, and wait for other people to do it. They're not going to do it. The welfarists have got a stranglehold on advocacy in the animal movement. The animal movement, which I'm not a part of, the welfarist movement, has a stranglehold on all the stuff. So you have to just get out there and do it in any way that you can. And in fact, what I'm going to do, I'm hoping that the webinar that happened yesterday is available now on the YouTube channel, so you can check it out, because the webinar is all about vegan advocacy. And there's 10 principles, 10 points, talking, you know, 10 pieces of advice that Gary and Anna did, and they're going to probably post those just as a list, just so people can sort of have a look at them. And they talk about them in the webinar, and then they answer questions from other people. But there's a new book coming out, which is so exciting, from Gary and Anna, about advocacy, and it's also about how to deal with welfarers. I'm hoping there's going to be something in there about that, you know, how to deal with welfarers. I don't know. But anyway, it's going to be great. So that's exciting, and that'll come out soon, because they're very prolific. And when they say there's a book coming out a few months later, there it is. So yeah, make 2017 your year to get something going. It doesn't have to be big and fancy. And another thing is, remember, this was what Gary said yesterday as well, there's a big network of abolitionists in the world. You're not alone. There are real abolitionists out there who are really the real deal, who are really dedicated, and there's a huge support network. And if you want to find them, the best place to start is to go on Gary Francione's Facebook page, which is called Gary Francione, the Abolitionist Approach to Animal Rights Facebook page, and just say, you know, I'm the only abolitionist in my town, which is 9 times out of 10 what I hear from people all over the world, and I know exactly what that's like. And I really want to sort of touch base with people and have sounding boards and discuss ideas and stuff. You know, where, you know, and then there you are. You're already in a community, and you'll have tons of people on that Facebook page reaching out to you from all over the world. So you're not alone. You're just physically, maybe they're not, you're next to a neighbor or in your city or even in your country, but they're there. We're here. We're all here on the planet doing our bit, you know, in our communities, and you can do it too. And I'm hoping that, I think things are going to be, it's going to be a great year. I mean, things have already accelerated so greatly in terms of veganism in New Zealand. It's amazing. I mean, I knew it was going to happen, but it's so nice to see it happening. And there's even a vegan shoe store that's opened up in Auckland, if I got that right. I'll have to check with my friend Will Paul, but I'm pretty sure it's a vegan shoe store. And I mean, if you'd have told me that 5 years ago, I mean, I would have said, yeah, of course it's going to be. I know that. But it's still nice to see it happening. It really, really is. We just have to get away from this whole vegetarianism rubbish and straight to the veganism, please. So we can get all the dairy products out of these restaurants who are, you know, they'd be vegan if they just would get rid of the flipping cow's milk from the coffee menu. I mean, come on. So let's see if we can make that happen, eh? Anyway, so Happy New Year, everybody. keep up all the really, really great work. I will keep you posted on how things go. I'll be posting food well, just like on. I started an Instagram because I used to have Flickr and I still have Flickr, but apparently Instagram's the way to go. So for my budget food that I'm going to be doing as a student, I'm going to post it on Instagram. But I think it's going to be quite repetitive. That's the only thing. I don't really get bored easily, and I'll just eat the same thing, like rice and beans and lentils and roti, and so it might get a bit repetitive. So I'm not sure how that's going to go, but we'll see. Alrighty. Thank you so much for listening, and I will definitely be back. Happy New Year.